In the closing days of World War II, as the once mighty Third Reich began falling apart at the seams, a litany of supposed wonder weapons were created with the intention of reversing the fortunes of the Reich. It's likely that you're already familiar with many of these, as the weapons have been the muse of military historians for decades now. Take the V-1 cruise missile, for example. This terrifying and revolutionary implement of destruction has been the focus of many a book and countless TV documentaries. What you may not know is that this famous weapon had a much lesser known and altogether more terrifying variant, the Fieseler Fi-103R Reichenberg, a manned suicide missile, and this is its story. By 1944, the tide was beginning to turn against Germany. In June, the D-Day invasion marked the beginning of a large-scale offensive by the Allies in Western Europe, and concurrently in the East, the Soviets were closing in on the borders of the Reich. The German military, with its situation looking ever worse, was looking for new and innovative ways to turn the tide, and as resources became ever scarcer, the options it considered became ever more unorthodox. The Reichenberg emerged from this atmosphere of desperation. Germany had never employed suicide planes, but as the situation grew increasingly desperate, the concept began to gain some traction, inspired directly by Japanese kamikaze tactics, wherein Japanese pilots would deliberately crash explosive-laden aircraft into enemy ships. These attacks caused significant damage and demoralized the enemy. Eventually, this inspiration turned into a simple idea. Take the V-1 and stick a pilot in it. So, now let's see how they went about converting the V-1 for manned flight. The project was initiated in the summer of 1944 under the leadership of Dr. Fritz Goslar, the chief engineer of the V-1, and Dr. Heinrich Lange, who had redesigned its guidance and control systems. Two main additions had to be made to the V-1 to make it suitable for manned flight. It had to have a cockpit and controls. To complicate matters, this had to be done without significantly altering the shape of the fuselage so that they could preserve its flight characteristics. But fortunately, removing the V-1's automatic guidance system freed up a handy amount of space. This space was, of course, filled by the cockpit, which was equipped with basic flight instruments such as an airspeed indicator, altimeter, compass, and throttle controls. A small bubble canopy was also added to provide the pilot with a clear view of their surroundings. Probably the most useful addition, however, was a simple gun sight mounted in the cockpit. This allowed the pilot to visually align the aircraft with the target during final approach, ensuring a pinpoint accuracy that simply wasn't possible with the V-1. Like the V-1 before it, the Reichenberg used an Argus AS-014 pulse jet, a type of jet engine that generates thrust by igniting a mixture of fuel and air in bursts rather than as a continuous mixture like the jet that takes you on holiday does. This gives them a unique sputtering tone. Now, depending on which historian you ask, this distinctive noise was either a major benefit or a serious drawback. The former group believed that it created a serious psychological impact, which terrified those on the ground, while the latter believed that the distinctive sound did nothing except warn people of an impending attack and give them some chance to hide. Now, one thing that is not up for debate is the effectiveness of this engine, though. It was cheap to produce, it was easy to maintain, and it generated a lot of power. And something else that didn't change was its warhead. It used the Germans' go-to explosive, Amatol, a deadly mixture of TNT and ammonium nitrate. 850 kilograms of it was crammed into the Reichenberg's nose, giving it a 548-meter radius of destruction from the point of impact. It also employed a variable fuse, which could be adjusted to detonate on impact or at a predetermined altitude, maximizing the destructive potential of the explosive force. Once all of this came together and the project neared completion, test pilots were needed. And this is where Hanna Reich, the pioneering female aviator, enters today's story. She was brought on board to conduct a series of test flights to assess and provide feedback on its handling, stability, and responsiveness. Recruiting Hanna proved to be a very prudent move, as the prototypes proved to be absolutely riddled with dangerous design oversights and manufacturing defects. Time and time again, she found herself in perilous situations that would have been the end of lesser pilots. For example, in one high-altitude test, she experienced an engine failure, and given the Reichenberg is only marginally more aerodynamic than, say, a brick, she found herself in a rapid and uncontrolled descent. Thanks to her exceptional skill and calm demeanor, she managed to regain control of the aircraft and execute a daring emergency landing. Another such incident found her without control surfaces, and once again she managed to guide the aircraft back home without sustaining injury. Without Hammer's input, the Reichenberg would have been a complete death trap, and not a death trap in the way it was intended to be a death trap. Further still, she also played a role in training and mentoring the Reichenberg's pilots. Her experience, expertise, and ability to instill confidence in the pilots was an invaluable asset to the program. So, this naturally sparks questions regarding who would be put behind the controls of an aircraft such as the Reichenberg. Well, so now let's explore that in more detail. Surprisingly, the pilots destined to fly the Reichenberg were all volunteers lured with promises of glory in the final, supposedly noble sacrifice to save their Reich. Contrary to what you might imagine, the project didn't seek out inexperienced pilots who would be considered more strategically disposable. Quite specifically, they wanted experienced pilots who possessed exceptional flying skills, and of course, those who were blindly loyal to the Nazi cause. The selected pilots, who were assembled under the banner of the Leonidas Squadron, were fully aware of the suicidal nature of their posting and were more than willing to make the ultimate sacrifice. Their motivations for volunteering varied. Some, such as First Lieutenant Dieter Field, were pure Nazi fanatics and all too happy to go out in a blaze of glory. For a smaller minority, such as Flight Sergeant Didi Kraus, they appear to have been driven by the promise of the ultimate, if final, adrenaline high. The training program for the Reichenberg pilots was rigorous, with a focus on mastering the unique flight characteristics of the aircraft, as well as honing the skills required for the final approach on the target. The initial training involved ground-based classroom instruction followed by flight training in different variants. The instructors, some of whom were experienced test pilots, provided guidance and support to the volunteers, helping them to develop the necessary skills and confidence to fly the Reichenberg. Given the nature of the Reichenberg, it was an obvious reason to make sure that they got it right the first time. Due to the inherent dangers of the high-speed, low-altitude flight profile of the Reichenberg, accidents during the training phase were not uncommon, and several pilots lost their lives. Despite this, the training program successfully prepared a group of pilots for the planned operational deployment of the Reichenberg. As we've just alluded to the existence of different variants, well, let us take the time quickly to cover what they were before finally getting to what happened when they tried to deploy this thing in combat. The first variant was the R1, a basic, unarmed, single-seat powered glider which allowed trainees to familiarize themselves with the Reichenberg's flight characteristics without the added complexity of the Pulsejet engine. Following Hannah Reich's near-fatal incident without power, they prudently decided not to fit unpowered variants with a dummy warhead. Next was the R2, which featured a second cockpit fitted where the warhead would normally be. This enabled dual pilot training and instructor guidance during flights. Like the R1 before it, this type was an unpowered glider. This was followed by the R3, another two-seater training variant like the R2, but this time with a pulse jet fitted as opposed to simply being a glider. As you could probably see from this, the Reichenberg variants got increasingly more complex with each iteration. This was very intentional, with the idea being that prospective pilots would be drip-fed more and more details of how it operated and be able to quickly build up a detailed understanding of the aircraft. Given the fact that combat deployment would have been a one-way trip, this approach was vital to make sure that the most damage was done with their single-use pilots. The ratcheting up of complexity culminated with the R4, the standard operational model. This was the variant intended for actual combat missions, and therefore it was equipped with all the features that we discussed earlier. This was also the most heavily produced variant because while the R1 through R3 were reusable, well, the R4 wasn't going to make any return flights. There is, however, one last and vastly different variant, the R5. This variant was completely unrelated to the suicide missile program and instead was produced by Heinkel as a trainer for their HE-162 jet fighter, with the logic being that it was a cheap and effective way to give trainee pilots some experience with a high-powered aircraft before they graduated to the HE-162. The Reichenberg was intended to be carried into combat under the wings of a Heinkel 111 mothership. Once in range, the Heinkel would release the Reichenberg mid-air, at which point the pilots would ignite the engines and begin their approach towards their designated target. This intended to maximize the range of the aircraft by giving the fuel-intensive duties of takeoff to another reusable aircraft, as well as effectively adding the range of the 111 to that of the Reichenberg. The intended operational use of the Reichenberg was a high-risk yet innovative strategy. The mothership would carry it under its wings, flying it towards the target, and once in range, the Heinkel would release it mid-air, at which point the pilot would ignite the pulse jet engine and hit their targets. There are some who claim that the Reichenberg pilots were meant to eject just before impact, but there are a couple of major issues with this theory. The first problem is practical, given the significant amount of metal immediately adjacent to the cockpit, all of which the pilot had a good chance of hitting during ejection. The second problem is one of validity. If you followed the paper trail of these claims, you eventually find your way to some apologist historians with some, well, rather unpleasant views on what the regime did or didn't do. For these reasons, it is typically assumed that the Reichenberg was always intended to be a suicide plane, and these claims to the contrary are just not really given much credence. But in many ways, this point is a moot one, because despite this debate, and despite all the resources and planning put into the Reichenberg, it was never actually deployed in combat. Why? Well, this can be attributed to two factors, namely the rapidly deteriorating situation faced by Germany, strategic priorities, and moral objections from within the party and the military leadership. Now, regarding the former point, as Germany continued to cede ground to the Allies and their resources continued to stretch ever thinner, they were faced with a decision: continue to pump resources into the Reichenberg, which was, after all, new and unproven, or instead pump those resources into churning out the maximum possible number of tried and tested aircraft. There was also the manpower aspect. Not only would the Reichenberg waste pilots, a most valuable commodity in wartime, but it also took them off the front line for months at a time while they underwent the arduous training for their one suicide mission, time that they could spend in a fighter shooting down enemy bombers. The final issue that prevented the Reichenberg from being deployed was a moral one. Apparently, even Nazis have lines that they aren't willing to cross, and for many, suicide missions proved to be that line. There are two anti-Reichenberg lobbyists to note in particular: Albert Speer, armaments minister, and Werner Brambach, commander of the Leonidas Squadron, the very formation that had been equipped with the aircraft. Both of them were not only respected figures in the party, but had power from their positions that they could weaponize against the Reichenberg. A single stroke of Hitler's pen ultimately terminated the Reichenberg program in October 1944, and still to this day, we're unsure exactly which of the aforementioned reasons was the direct impetus. All we could do as historians is gesture vaguely in the direction of all of them and let you make up your own minds. Mercifully, aircraft such as the Reichenberg are few and far between, with the only real other example of a dedicated suicide plane being the Okasuka MXY-7 Oka. This was developed by Japan during World War II. Like the Reichenberg, the Oka was essentially a bomb with a cockpit and an engine, but it differed notably in its design and operational deployment. While the Reichenberg was adapted from the V-1, the Oka was a purpose-built suicide aircraft designed from the ground up. The Oka was smaller and lighter than the Reichenberg and was equipped with a more powerful rocket motor, all of which allowed it to achieve much higher speeds. Like the Reichenberg, it was carried by a mothership aircraft, typically a Mitsubishi G4M, and released in the vicinity of its target, allowing it to conserve its limited fuel for its final approach. Unlike the Reichenberg, however, the Oka was actually used in combat, with its most notable success occurring on the 12th of April 1945 when several Okas managed to sink the American destroyer USS Manner at El Abalay. The Oka's high speed and rocket propulsion made it difficult to shoot down during its final approach. Despite this, however, their overall success was limited, and not a single capital ship was ever sunk by one. And so ends our video on the Fiesler Fi-103R Reichenberg, one of the Nazis' most harebrained and, well, morally repulsive weapons of war. Amidst the chaos of a losing war, the Reichenberg represented a desperate attempt by a crumbling regime to reverse its fortunes with outside-the-box thinking and a complete disregard for the lives of those who had sworn their allegiance to it. As we reflect on the Reichenberg's development and intended purpose, it serves as a chilling reminder of the depths of desperation and the lengths to which evil men can go when pushed to the brink of defeat. The Reichenberg story not only highlights the ingenuity of its designers, but also the moral and ethical boundaries that mankind will happily cross in the name of warfare. Fortunately, the kamikaze cruise missile never saw combat, sparing the lives of both its pilots and potential victims. Yet the lessons it teaches us remain relevant today as we continue to grapple with the consequences of unchecked military ambition and the devaluation of human life in times of conflict. So as we conclude, let the Reichenberg serve as a somber reminder of the darker aspects of human nature and the importance of vigilance against the forces that can drive us to such destructive ends.